Welcome to What the Hex, your source for Warhammer Underworlds in under 30 inconveniently placed lethal hexes. I'm your co-host, Davey, and with me as always, I got Phil. How are you doing, Phil?
Doing great. We got this new Beastgrave stuff.
Yeah.
So excited.
And back by special request from the masses, we have one of the OGs of Underworlds podcast, and we got Jeff Moore from Claim the City fame. How are you, Jeff?
I'm doing good. I am equally hyped for Beastgrave.
Yeah.
More cards for my dwarves.
All right. Well, we're going to jump into that in just a second here. We'll get some housekeeping out of the way. You can, well, obviously the context of this show is Beastgrave has just released a streak date, just is actually today. So you'll, this is a rare What the Hex episode dropping just a couple days after it's recorded. So in that respect, we do have a couple in the bank. We've got an interview with Warhammer Underworlds Online, and we have some discussion about hold objective play. Both those will be released, but there may be some timey-wimey stuff for the Doctor Who fans out there, where we'll skip around there. But if you want to get in touch with us, and people have been doing that, I really appreciate that. It's at WTHcast. Find us on Facebook and all the places that we just kind of roam around. We use the Mortal Realms Facebook page often for posting things, and then send us an email, whatthehexcast@gmail.com. For community shout outs, I feel like I always shout these guys out, but Underworlds DB, they've made some amazing updates for their deck builder. Just some visual, some of the filters. Sounds like you agree, Jeff.
I was so happy. I went onto it and I was just already like, it's all there.
Yeah.
So easy to use, clean UX. It's really lovely.
Yeah, they've really been doing a great job. Phil, you got any shout-outs?
Yeah, just with the amount of content that's been coming out and the amount of content that's been getting sort of leaked early, I just kudos to the Warhammer community team for just holding it together and keeping giving us great articles despite, you know, having some stuff get out ahead of their articles.
Sure. Yeah. I think that probably makes it even more frantic on their end, you know, trying to stay up with leaks and such. So we'll keep it rolling. We have a lot to cover today. We're going to be, of course, covering Beastgrave and all the new developments that are dropping. We're going to take a quick second to say what the hex is going on with us. Jeff, I hear you talking about what cards you can fit into your dwarf decks. Specify what kind of dwarves are you talking about?
Well, actually, I'm talking about both.
Nice.
I went out last night and at my local store because the season one stuff is obviously discontinued. They had all the season one boxes on sale, mm-hmm. and I bought another box of the Fire Slayers because I was like, well, I'm a much better painter than I was when I painted my first Fire Slayers. And I actually think that with the rotation, the reduced lethality, the new guard changes, there's actually a world where like I could really enjoy playing these again. So I bought them and built them last night, and they're literally sitting on my table next to me, and I'm going to prime them after this.
That is nice. Very cool. I have a Underworlds model on the little sort of paint holder, and it is Tefk. So
there we go.
I'm trying like a sort of frost giant theme, so blue skin, white beards, icy weapons. I haven't quite stuck the landing on it, but it's what's fun about doing these little Underworlds warbands. You can try a little project out.
We'll talk about that later. I had a really interesting moment about the Flesh Eater Cult that was like preview that was released this morning.
Mm, yeah,
where I would never buy one of those models ever. Like, doesn't interest me at all. And I was showing my girlfriend, and she's like, oh, those are really cool. I want to paint those bats. And I was like, yeah, well, I'm going to buy the warband because I play the game. And you know what? Yeah, I will paint them. And that's cool. And I've never painted zombies in any of these games before. It's just not a thing that ever motivates me.
Yeah.
But Underworlds, like, makes you just, you know, like painting Zinch stuff last year. And I've realized it's actually making me a better painter.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fun. It's a great way to check out some other techniques and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's been a nice using this rotation. It sounds like is an excuse to kind of go shake things up. I've been playing some with Gits, some with Chosen Axes, some with Far Striders, and mm-hmm. of course a little bit with the Despoilers. So it's been fun from several different hobby aspects. Phil, what have you been doing?
Similar stuff, trying out new things, trying to sort of figure out where is the meta sort of going to settle here. Tried Curse Breakers again, towards heavy magic, just to see, like, with reduced lethality and some of the sort of better cards for movement and stuff coming out, that I think there's some more gas in that engine now. And then also really excited about the Wild Hunt, but I tried them out a little bit already and liked what I saw, so trying to piece together some decks now rather than just playing them out of the box.
Very cool. All right, so we're going to talk Beastgrave. We got a ton to cover here, a rough overview of some things we're going to hit. We're going to just talk about our sort of overall impression and some of the visual components, and then the figures, the boards, that sort of thing. We'll talk about what we saw from rules updates as far as stuff in the box, and then there will be also some of the stuff that's kind of come out in parallel, some of the changes to organized play and such. We'll talk about our impressions of the warbands, and then sort of our impressions from gameplay, and some of those will all bleed into each other, so we'll skip around a little bit. And then we've got some eyes on some of the things that are coming down, coming along, so we'll talk about that at the end, do a little cleanup. We have some listener questions. I'm going to do my best to slot those in as they come. And we'll do a little cleanup at the end of hitting those up. So let's kick it off with the visuals. I know for me, like, it's just striking that it comes out and the whole color palette, the whole tone has changed. Like, you have this red, amber sort of tone to the boards and to the box and to the art and that sort of thing. That was more refreshing than I thought it would be. It was pretty cool. So, Jeff, you said you went cover to cover on the rule book last night. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, actually, before we get to the rule book on the box, I have a lot to say and agree with you on.
All right.
I agree. I love the palette change. I think it supports the sort of the presentation of the narrative shifting from outside of Shadespire and the Night Vault. We're in a totally different part. The exclusion of there being a Stormcast or sort of human unit in the core box is actually really exciting. Mm-hmm. I had some friends who didn't come back for season two, who when they learned it was Beastmen and a new type of elf, were like, oh, that's cool. Like, I'm down for that.
Sure.
And then I actually, just the merchandising of the box itself, for anyone who, like, doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about this or is interested in learning more, if you can, when you go buy your season 3 box, you're probably going to see a season 2 box on the shelf. Pick both of them up and look at the back of them. The season 3 box does an incredible job on the back to explain to somebody who has no idea what they're looking at what this is. Mm-hmm. You have 2-scale models fully painted that you're like, oh, wow, like, I can hold that in my hand and be like, that's how big that would be. And then the 3-panel at the bottom, like, really clearly explains what this game is, which is a deck game with miniatures, not a miniature game with cards, but that's a separate problem. But you see the entire board state. You see it involves cards. You have characters. You have a deck that you build. And it does a much better job, I thought, than season 1 of communicating all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, in conjunction with a bunch of stuff in the rules, there's really this aspect where if you've listened to some of the Stormcast episodes recently, and if you had the guy on from Underworlds Online, I think he probably mentioned it, but, like, they really want to push this as their ultra-competitive game.
Mm-hmm.
And I really get that sense from looking at the back of the box that it's the color palette's a nice refresh. It moves the narrative forward. It stands out from previous ones. You're like, oh, what's that different? And in comparison, on a shelf that's fully stocked with current AOS and Warhammer stuff, Warhammer boxes are all that sort of dark grayish blue, and AOS is all that white. And then all of a sudden, you have this splash box, which almost looks like Kill Team colors.
Sure.
And it really stands out from a merchandising standpoint. And then when you pick it up and flip it around, if you have no idea, so at our local store, when we're talking about this sort of stuff, we sort of group players into 4 categories, which is casual, competitive, considering, and clueless. And so casual and competitive we're very familiar with. Considering are often players who, like, go to your store for board game night or for D&D night or other games or Magic, and they're looking into miniature games, and Shadespire Underworlds, much like Kill Team, is a pathway for a lot of those people. And Clueless is the sort of person who hasn't picked up one of these games in 20 years, the person who just happens to be in the store with a partner or with a friend, or is there because their kids are playing, you know, Pokemon or Magic in the store. And we actually started taking the box when the store got the demo copy last week and there was a Pokemon tournament going on. We actually took the box over to some parents who were just sort of chilling and talking on their phones. Mm-hmm. And we put it in, we're like, can you tell us what this game is? And they were able to look at it and then they're like, yeah. And they roughly were able to describe it. But when we took a Kill Team box or even X-Wing, mm-hmm. A Song of Ice and Fire, just it didn't connect in the same way. Like, they weren't able to piece it together. And I think that that's a really big achievement, and it's really, really awesome.
Yeah.
Because, go ahead.
Well, I think you wouldn't want to gloss over that, because the more accessible the game is, the easier it is for other people to pick up, the more it'll grow and the more people you have to play against. So I think that's something I had overlooked, but it's a pretty cool bump.
So, I wonder if they were thinking about that since this was obviously being designed alongside Dreadfane. And since Dreadfane is like the really entry level version of the game, I wonder if they were just like had this sort of exposure idea forefront when they were designing everything. And they're like, let's make this as accessible as possible.
I think you're probably right on the money. And what it is, you know, Dreadfane, I'm in Southern California. So Dreadfane here is on sale on shelves at Target and Barnes & Noble. And if you're on, and from my professional experience, I can tell you, if you're on sale in those stores, they have a lot of expertise and recommendation on how to position things from a merchandising standpoint in terms of copy on the box and presentation. And I bet you GW learned a lot that they didn't know before because they'd never been in that kind of a retail environment. And I bet you it absolutely informed them, and then it leveled up what the box looks like.
Sure. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, while we're still, so you went cover to cover on the rule book, right?
I did go cover to cover on the rule book. Yeah. And in the same vein, I will say on the back cover of the rule book is another step in a great direction, which is it is a very tight and clean combat sequence laid out. Mm-hmm. And then it also has the determining success table, which is so wonderful. Because one of the things we had at a couple of tournaments I had was newer players came in, and some of the, crit with success versus other crit moments happened, and players had thought they'd won games, and then we had to walk it back and explain it to them. And with this table, you really feel like you got a much better chance coming in knowing exactly what it is. And it's not buried in a paragraph. It's much easier to read. Sure. And for me, I think, these flowcharts are the sign of tight combat systems and cleaner rules, which I really liked. Overall, the cover to cover in the book, a lot of fluff at the start. I didn't read. Never do. But I'm happy it's there because it appeals to a lot of people. And I think it's beautifully laid out. And I love that we're not going to some lower level of the same city. Like, we're moving around the world and introducing a new faction that we've never seen before with this. I'll get nitty gritty and you can stop me where you want.
Okay.
I thought page 16, which is where they lay out the battlefield and they have a chart and a legend that shows what each hex is qualified as, again, really helps to clear up a lot of issues around incomplete hexes, which is something that we had in our local meta, as well as no one's territory, are very well defined and very clearly laid out, and you can understand how they're going to relate to other things. There's a couple of FAQ rules that made it in the book that were updated, which was really nice. So the line of sight, which is that if line of sight goes through an incomplete hex, it blocks it, which it wasn't the case, and then they made it the case, which I think is a good call. Did you notice the change in the place board steps?
Yeah. So we got, you're talking about the roll off, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
They finally did it.
Yeah.
They did it.
So just in case anyone's not sure, we're talking about when you roll off in the previous first two seasons, it would be if I lost the roll off, then I had to place a board first. And here, if whoever wins decides who's going to place that board. So you decide who's the winner of the roll off is going to decide who has the advantage on placing objectives versus placing boards. I think that's a great change.
Yep. And then it also implicitly gives you control, because on the next page, it's whichever player chooses the first game board takes tokens and places it face down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so it really is bringing objective play back up, and the sort of build on that is if you jump ahead to the token section, I think the addition of super actions, which we'll go in a second, is great, but guard is substantially more powerful now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is that change we saw in Dreadfane, where if you're on guard, you cannot be driven back.
Yeah. And I think it does two things that are really healthy for the game. One is it makes it for specifically dwarves, but objective factions in general, to be able to go onto objectives, go on guard, mm-hmm. and feel comfortable in that space and go, the only thing that can move me off of here is push cards.
Yep. Push cards are just getting killed, right? Like there's,
yeah.
Yeah.
So that's and that was one of those things. So there's a number of those that we were seeing in Dreadfane. Just to go back to the board placement, one of the reasons I think that's so great is that it's another piece where you can identify what's more important in this matchup. Is it more mm-hmm. important for me to have the objectives on my side or deny them from my opponent or be able to, to have control of placing the objectives, or more important to have control of placing the boards? And so I like that instead of it just being decided for you, it gives you another choice, and that's another chance for play and counterplay, and rewards the players who understand the matchup that they're going into.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think that takes out some of the frustration of situations where you knew you needed to lose the roll off mm-hmm. and then like you have no control over it, but it's such a weird feeling to be like, I need to lose this roll off because I want the not winning effect. So having the choice makes it just like, I don't know. There's like a psychological feeling of if you win, it should be better.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
I think it's agency. You associate winning with agency.
Yeah. That's right. A great point.
And I think what it is you psychologically, when you win, but you lose agency, you're like, this is hollow and frustrating.
Yeah. Right. Well, and then I like also that it creates interesting moments of, so I've played a couple where I lost the roll off. Then my opponent got to decide, whether they wanted, to place a board first or second and then have the objective. And they went a direction I didn't expect and made me step back and be like, oh wait, what's going on with their deck? Are they doing something that I'm not expecting? Like, yep. So that's fun as well. So,
yep.
Yeah.
Now, in the place board rules, just to say on the same thing, and jumping over to include also the matched play rules at the end. Mm-hmm. Now, I haven't reviewed the Grand Clash stuff that was released today, but this does not use the language of needing to bring multiple boards that they were using in the Grand Clash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they've maintained that in the Grand Clash portion.
In the Grand Clash rules, but it's not in the matched play of the book then. Okay.
Yeah, and I think that was standard previously, and just that, like, the rule basically only applies for major tournaments, which I think is good. Although with board rotation, maybe they'll take out the Grand Clash rule. I don't know. We'll maybe. See.
Yeah. I'm interested to see it, because I expected it to be in here, because they clearly define in match play that it's a best of three. What victories are, what are the tiebreakers, and so forth. And it actually reads in a way that it's really good for a store to just know, oh, this is the little bit I need to do to make sure that I can deliver this kind of an event. Mm. And I sort of expected it to be in there. And I get that the core box only comes with effectively four sides. Mm-hmm. So you just bring both. But I was anticipating it would be in there.
Sure.
But either way, it's still nice that they've cleaned up the role part of it, and that we have... Even if they removed it, we have clear match play rules.
Mm-hmm. Well, while we're on the subject of board placement and token placement, let's talk about that lethal thing. So this is new, and this is not something that obviously we didn't see it in Dreadfane, because there wasn't any placing of objectives or lethals for that matter. So Phil, you want to talk to us about how that placement works, and then we'll give some thoughts on it.
Yeah, so it's just like with objective token placement. It basically just continues the same sort of step. You finish placing the tokens in the order like you normally would, where the person who lost or the person who placed board first finishes placing the last token, and then then the person who didn't place the board first gets to place a lethal token if they want to. It is optional. And it's this, it's essentially the same placement rules, except that there's no spacing requirement. So just any open hex that's not a deployment hex. And then your opponent gets to place one if they want as well. So every single match theoretically is going to have two additional lethal hexes, and it's even more important where those go, I think, than where the objective tokens go, because it's going to have such an outsized impact on combat, especially if you get to put one like right behind your opponent's deployment hexes, and you know you're going to be able to push fighters into those on first turn.
Yeah, so let's talk more about that impact. You're talking about pushing people in. What I noticed in our games is if you are a large warband, you're unlikely to be able to get away from it. So I think in our last game, my board had two starting hexes next to each other, and I knew I could leave at most one of those empty because I had six fighters in my warband. And so you place the lethal behind the two of those, and so that guaranteed that I was going to place somebody in a spot that could be pushed in on the very first turn.
Yeah. Well, and so, you know, there's the avoidance. You can also use them as sort of a screening mechanic. And obviously people sort of latched onto this right away, and they were like, hey, look, I can set off, you know, offset the boards to the maximum, and then on certain boards, I could just place the lethal hex right there in the sort of the middle area, and now there's almost no safe hexes to move through to get across the board. So there's some of that sort of screening block out type of play. If you want to keep your opponents at a distance, or if you're like ghosts and you just don't care and you're just like, well, I'm just gonna have this advantage, you can really clog the board.
Yeah. And to Jeff's point earlier about guard being especially important, it becomes even more important here. Where not only is it important for objective warbands, hold objective warbands that don't want to get pushed off their objectives, it's important for anybody who doesn't want to get pushed into a lethal.
For sure.
So I wonder if as they're going, they're like, oh, you know what, we need a way to prevent drive back. And unfortunately, I'm using push and drive back interchangeably. They're two different things. But
yeah.
So.
I think the other little subtle thing is you actually just after you place the objective tokens, you actually reveal all of the objective tokens before you place the lethal hex.
I did not notice that.
Yeah, that's in the third paragraph halfway down. It's once all tokens have been placed, turn them over, revealing the numbered side. Each player may then choose to add one lethal hex, and it goes into how they do that. And so, you know, based on your hand and the deck you've constructed, it also allows you to have even more control over trying to indicate or even feint certain objectives that you do want to try to take and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Which I really like. You know, it's just another sort of bluffing aspect of the game that can be inside of that.
Sure. And I think they talked about this where, so in the past I've said, you know, in general, my preference is take the second activation, like let the other person do something first. But when there's a lethal, maybe it has been placed then behind a hex that you want to be hanging out in. I can say again, the same thing where all of a sudden I was forced to put a fighter in a spot where, one damage and a push and a lethal would kill off a guy. That puts a lot more pressure on me to maybe take the first activation to either move that person away or put them on guard or get that fighter activated before they get killed. And I think it's a good thing, like put more pressure on the decision making as far as that goes. So that's a what I've seen is another side effect.
Absolutely.
Yeah. One side mention about match play, they may end up having some, they may be leaving the door open to changing what your requirements for placement are. I think I saw one of these they talked about in the in competition play, that there would be the possibility that they have some additional restrictions on where tokens are placed. So that it didn't say anything specific, but that seemed like a thing that they were maybe leaving the door open for. I'm not sure.
That would be interesting. I do wonder though, like from just a game health perspective, like if the tournament rules and not casual, but just normal store play rules start to become too divergent, it becomes hard. Because people who want to prepare for tournaments are always going to want to play with the tournament rules, but other people might not be. And if you start having a lot of extra rules sort of tacked on, I feel like it could have a potentially negative effect, either in that it's too much for people to have to keep track of, and so one rule set just sort of goes away, or it could be the situation of somebody didn't know that there were these other rules, and then they get caught off guard. So, I mean, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I'm fine with it either way, but I do wonder from like a total community perspective if that's going to be something that they want to try and shy away from a little bit, just because too many sort of rules that are coming from an outside source. It's sort of like, you know, regular Warhammer. It's like, well, you've got your General's Handbook, and you've got your core rulebook, and you've got your faction rulebook, and then you've got your supplemental rulebooks, and all of a sudden it's like...
And then you have pitched battles and match play.
So,
you know, yeah.
And so you don't want that kind of bloat where it's coming from all these disparate sources and then trying to hobble together this rule set, because then people get... It then becomes a competition of, can you keep track of the rules sometimes? And I don't necessarily think that that's a great thing for games. But so far we haven't really seen that here. So I think what we've seen added is good, and what is different in tournament play so far has not diverged too much.
Yeah. So let's see. We're gonna talk about some of the other rule things that we've seen come up, and then we're gonna give some overall thoughts about that when we got so one thing that there's not a lot of info on yet is the Hunter Quarry mechanic, but that appears to be the mechanic for this season that may be the equivalent of what casters were in Nightfall. So a new mechanic introduced. Let's see, Skaith's Wild Hunt, everyone but the Lion, the Malkin, is a hunter in the Beastmen. All four of the Ungors are hunters, and there's a upgrade that lets a generic fighter become a hunter, but that's the only way currently that older warbands are bringing a hunter into the mix. Right now, there's not a huge impact in being hunter or quarry, but it looks like there's somewhere that it could go. You've got any thoughts about where it is now versus where it might go, Jeff?
I mean, I really like... There's two things about it right now that I'm a big fan of. One, I like the inclusion of keywords in general in cards. I think it further supports my desire to see reprints of the earlier warbands in new packs, getting, like, just do a card pack upgrade of them, where they give them all keywords. I think it's cool. I also really like that in between the two warbands, you see Carthane is a wizard who's a hunter, but... So you know wizards can be hunters, but in the other warband, their wizard isn't, or the wizard isn't, the Fellhoof isn't a hunter, and that Draknar isn't. So you know that, like, they are seemingly using this in varied ways, and you know it's cool to have a bunch of chafe units in the Ungors that are hunters. That's like, okay, they're gonna get some rerolls and potentially other things, and I like it. It's a start of a mechanic that I want to see where it goes. But overall, it's tightened up keywords, and I'm down for that.
Sure. And interesting, despite multiple predictions on my part that never came true, I kept expecting there was some way to that they'd make to have a non-wizard become a wizard in Nightfall. You know, I thought we'd see that in Power on the Ground or something like that. Never saw it. Right out of the gate, we see there's a way to make a non-hunter into a hunter. So that'll be interesting to see how good the hunter mechanic is versus, you know, like, are there fighters that it's worth spending the effort to make them into a hunter? Like, if it comes with some pretty nice stuff, making Molag into a hunter could, you know, give him some extra juice, right? They're already showing that they're going to handle it in a little bit of a different way. So it'll be to some degree accessible by every warband, whether you are a Beastgrave warband or not. Now, Beastgrave clearly is going to have a step up because some of them at least will have natural hunters in there.
Yeah. I do. So from looking at what is already out in terms of Hunters and the Quarry effect, which nothing is by nature a quarry yet, I do wonder if it's going to have some deck space problems like Magic did early on, where if you need cards to be able to, one, make a fighter a hunter, and then two, to gain some benefit from being a hunter, that it may be too hard to sort of justify the space. And so I kind of wonder where that's going to land. Because right now, I mean, other than the in-faction cards that are hunter-specific, we didn't see a whole lot of generics get printed, and really only one of them has to do with the hunter mechanic, in that it makes somebody a hunter or it makes somebody a quarry. And then I guess like Snare is technically hunter specific, but that's just Pit Trap that's limited to hunters.
Yep, that's true. Although Snare is a great example of a pretty powerful card, whether or not it gets restricted. I mean, it's the equivalent of Pit Trap, just more limited to Hunter. So it may end up being an unrestricted Pit Trap that only goes on Hunters. In which case, if there's effects like that, it might be that might be powerful enough to you know, bring in some Hunters in your warband. But remains to be seen.
I really like the fact they also have the ploys give them pushes.
Yeah.
And then extra dice. It really is. It allows them to make cards that make. And specifically in the Despoiler deck, but like it makes the Ungors have the potential to sort of prove their worth without just being cards. It sort of, you go back to like, I think of Gurzag. Mm-hmm. Like it's if these had existed in the Orc Warband, it was ways in which, you know, the lesser orcs would try to prove that they're bigger.
Sure.
But the way you would play Gurzag was, it was like, no, I'm just gonna put this upgrade on Gurzag so he'll hit even harder.
Right.
And
yeah.
This incentivizes you to actually try to look for other opportunities, and it opens up more play variants by providing the new sort of keyword route, which is really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, but it further emphasizes why I do feel they need to print more generics, and we'll get to cards later, but they need to print more generics that use Hunter. But it does make me feel like I really do hope they do a reprint at some point of the other cards with keywords. But we might need to wait another season where there are more than one keyword, or wait for later in the season where they introduce a keyword other than Hunter.
Mm.
Right. Which would be interesting.
Yeah. If they, do you think we'll see a fighter that is, I'm trying to think of what fighter might be out there that would be an innate quarry, like just has quarry printed on their card.
Skaven.
Skaven is a good call. Yeah, absolutely. I feel like you could do Skaven. I feel like you could potentially make it an orc, and one of the, like, you could have like a lesser, you have a smaller orc.
Mm-hmm.
If because it looks like we're getting savage orcs and brutes in this wave, white, that's on the cards. Heart, I know we have brutes.
We don't really have anything definitive that would suggest the savage orcs. There's some.
Well, isn't stuff. Great fortitude, or is that metal too brutish on great fortitude? I don't know, but
I don't know either, and that's why I say we don't have anything definitive.
You're right, but I could see that. I mean, goblins. I could see some goblin that we know we're getting the Wolf Riders, which looks so cool.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Well, so I think we've covered most of the rules changes that we saw in the in the box set itself. Go ahead.
One thing that I think maybe, and I don't know if I just thought I read this or if I actually read this, did they change how lethals work, where if you get placed in a lethal hex now you take damage as well?
Yeah, so it used to be you had to move or push into them. Now if you place in them, so via confusion or something like that, and I think that'll only pop up a few times, but I think it's more intuitive. Like it was one of those rules where somebody would confusion you into a lethal, and you say, well, actually I don't take damage. I know that doesn't seem to make sense, but you know, but there it is. So
a few more little cleanups that they've done that I really like, actually starting in the combat sequence, clarifying outmaneuvered, which is specifically in steps 2 to 5, if the target of the attack is no longer visible or within range, which is basically a reaction can trigger to do that. Mm-hmm. It's just a really clean exit of like, do I still get to make this attack? It's like, no, there's a very clean rule that lets you do that now.
Sure.
Right.
I really like clarifying the rule that lethal hex damage is separate damage from the attack.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's important too. I was going to say this. It means that when you're getting ready to score your objectives, pay close attention, because if you make that killing blow or do a certain amount of damage because of the lethal, it may not score you an objective. You know, like it came up with us, Phil, where you killed a guy with a charge, but it was a charge that did a damage and pushed into the lethal, so the objective didn't score. There's some that need your warband to take a number. I've been working with the far striders that have a score immediately if you take two fighters out of action, two enemy fighters out of action or something. So you just got to pay attention. Does it say, are two enemy fighters out of action? Or does it say, did your warband take two enemy fighters? Or was it an attack action that needed to do it? So there's several different iterations, and with the lethal axes being so much more prominent, even than they were in the calculated risk era, which we're still firmly in, it's time to make sure that you understand how that interacts, and they're aware of that. Like you said, Jeff, they put a special call out in the rules about it.
I also like that they put the call out for backlash, which is the effect of if you roll double crits. Mm-hmm. It says that the wizard is dealing the damage to himself, basically.
Right.
Okay.
And so I feel like there are potentially warbands in which they could be incentivized for that, or it would be a boon, which is really nice. And then they've also clarified heal, which is that you need to remove a token, which is what we saw in the fact, but you need to remove at least one token for it to be considered a heal, which is super dope.
Mm-hmm.
And very cleaned up. And then the other two things that I can remember. Oh, no. So there's three more things. One is ensnare as a mechanic is here, which is basically the cleave of dodges.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Which is dope.
Let me spin off, because we do have a question about that.
Great.
Yep. It was Jeff Osborne. Canadian Jeff, shout out.
And it's another GEO, if I'm not mistaken, if I saw that.
It is.
Yeah. He would love to hear our thoughts on the effect of ensnare on the meta. So now that ensnare exists as its own rule, how impactful do you think that is? Not just that it's its own rule, but that we're theoretically seeing more of it around.
I would need more data to be able to really say the impact of the meta. As of right now, I can say I think it's only positive.
Mm-hmm.
Which is great.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think it was needed. When you got into a space where having block was not as good as having dodge, it started to feel weird. And there still are a lot of warbands where you can get to three or four dodge pretty easily, and it becomes very hard to hit those fighters unless you have some way around it. And so ensnare is a nice way to balance that back off. In terms of the meta, from what I've seen so far, I just don't think there's enough of it yet for it to feel really like it's going to make a huge impact, at least not right away. But where I do think it'll have an outsized impact is against, like, ghosts. Because they're all dodge, and a lot of them are one dodge, so some of those early turns with ensnare could suddenly become very bad for them.
Sure.
So it, knowing that they're one of the better warbands currently, you could see them have a few more headaches to try and deal with.
Yeah. Oh, I think almost more impactful than ensnare becoming more enshrined as a mechanic is the loss of last chance on those dodge warbands, right?
Oh, like, sure, yeah.
Because that's what felt real oppressive. You finally get an attack through that made it through Snurk or Ulthari with a couple extra dodge upgrades, and then they drop last chance on you, and all your hard work went down the toilet. So.
Yep.
Yeah.
I will also say, and this is on the same rules of scything, which is a new keyword, which is really just a clarification of an ability that we saw on the Wardens, I guess, and Steelheart?
Yep, Steelheart had it when Inspired.
And then I don't remember anybody else.
Karsus the Chained had it when he's Inspired.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Moloch has it. There's a few spots where it crops up, but it's relatively rare. Galangin has it for all the times he gets Inspired.
Oh, yeah.
But it's basically clarifying attacking multiple adjacent units. And it defines that it's a super action.
Mm-hmm.
which is a cool new thing of both charges are super actions and this is super actions, which is great.
Any action that is made up of multiple actions, whether it's a move, you know, so a charge being a move and attack or scything being multiple attacks.
Which is great because it also clarifies that if you inspire during a super action, you don't inspire, which isn't great for orcs, but, you know, they were so good already that they clearly needed this nerf.
Dragging down.
Yeah, exactly. They really needed to go to the bottom of the tier. But the other part I like it is it also clarifies that effects that are affecting the attack only affect the first attack.
Yep.
And it's just really those sorts of clarity pieces are just for me a real sign of just tighter rule language, and they make me more excited for the season.
Totally. Definitely agree.
Yeah. And then the last one on tighter rule language is reaction to reactions on page 29, which is so they've reaction window is as it was before. When a reaction is triggered, the next activating player has the opportunity to react first. You can only react once per window. But if a reaction causes an opportunity for another reaction, they've clarified the order of how it's going to go here. And it's really nice because it's the player who did not play the... So a reaction window shows up. One player plays a reaction and then creates an environment. It's the player who didn't play that first reaction has the first opportunity to do that.
Sure.
And it's just, again, it's a nice, tighter rule. You know the order of it. And I don't know of any specific combos yet where we're going to see that come up. But I feel like it'll inevitably happen over the course of the season. And knowing at the beginning they're sort of thinking through that, it's just really comforting and encouraging with the game.
Yeah. Sure.
So.
And reactions have always been this area of sort of iffy questioning of like, well, what's the real timing here? And anything that's going to clarify that, I think, is just healthy for the game.
Agreed.
Just won't need as many facts, and it's just going to make games go so much smoother.
Yeah, I can't totally agree. No argument here on that.
So I think what we're going to do now, we'll take a little bit to talk about the two warbands that came in. Then we'll cover some of the changes that are being announced alongside, and then talk about some sort of big picture impressions that we're getting of the game. So obviously everyone knows at this point, two warbands, Gasherax Despoilers and Skaith's Wild Hunt. Jeff, which one of those are you more excited for?
I think the spoilers, but it's pretty split. I mean, they're obviously not dwarves, so they're not top tier. But I really like Beastmen in Total War Warhammer 2. I really enjoyed playing through a Beastmen campaign, which was really nice. I don't normally like elves that much, but these guys are pretty druidy, which is cool, and I like that. I just like the idea of having a Bestigor on the board.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really cool unit in the lore, and the model looks amazing.
Yeah.
And like I've said, I do like the idea of having the sort of Ungors, which are the lesser models in it, having a chance with hunter triggers to hopefully do something relevant. So that's probably the one I'm the most excited to play right now.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously after I get a fair amount of reps on Fire Slayers and on Thunderers.
So yeah, let's take a minute to jump in what we know. So we talked about you've got four pretty chaffy dudes and then the Bestigor and the leader. They have some pretty cool objectives that a number of them that are score immediately, but they score immediately that revolve around positioning. And I thought that was pretty interesting. So one of them is two glory score immediately if you're holding three objectives. I think that one's called Despoilers. And so that's real powerful, right? So it's like our only way out, only you get to score it immediately. But I like that it's positioning based. That you can work towards it and the other player can work against it. I know in our last game, I had to decide that I was going to sacrifice the chance to finish off one of your fighters in exchange for I'll charge, lay some damage on somebody else, but also score this immediately at the end. You know, it was the right choice, but I like that you're getting pulled in different directions. And you, as the other player, can kind of take a look and say, okay, well, I'm going to cover up this objective to make it that much harder to play for. So And they've got some that are, you know, being in enemy territory or holding an objective in enemy territory or different things like that. So real interesting objectives that give a flex a sort of non-combat-y way to pick up glory, but that you may also be able to, you know, continue to attack, you know, charge a bow-armed Ungor onto an objective, so you're still getting to chip in some damage as you go and try and make this happen.
Yeah, and also I think the fantasy within the warband is really well done. Of they have two tiers of each Ungor, so there's two tiers of spearmen,
mm-hmm.
where they have Sneak, who basically has hidden paths as an action.
Yeah,
yep.
Which thematically is dope because, you know, they're all about ambushing and sneaking up on armies and like just sort of surprising you with overwhelming force, and it's nice to have a spearman who can do that. And he does have two dodge versus one when inspired, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't do a ton of damage, but it's one of those things of like there's a lot of cards now that try to give a little bit more lethality and get him there.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side they have a bowman who has ensnare, which yeah. on three swords is nice. Like you're also thinking to be like, oh, he's gonna do, you know, a critical piece of damage and a pushback at one point, but then you've got just a crappy little Ungor who just has a bow and a cheap, I think it's called a flint axe.
Yeah.
And yeah. like, you know, that's just, it's just cool. There's more diversity in the bottom end and they're doing it. And I also really like that they didn't make the best Ungor the leader and they made it the Bray Shaman.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, cool. Yeah. Cause you just want to play the Bray Shaman defensively. And then, yeah, it's well executed.
So my take on them, there's the interesting, or I should say, on a particular fighter, they have the half horn in there. He mm-hmm. he's an Ungor, but he's got an extra point of health, and he's doing two damage out of the gate. And so I feel like he occupies this weird middle ground in between the Gore and Vestigore and the rest of the Ungors. And so I think, my impression was that a lot of games may hinge around how well you leverage him, how well you trade him. Or use him because he's hitting a little bit harder, absorbing a little bit more damage than the other guys, and so he's a way to squeeze a little bit more juice out of that warband. And so how you do that is a big deal. We haven't even talked about the ritual counter, right?
No,
haven't even mentioned it yet.
Did you buy your ritual counter box?
Oh, is it out yet? I don't know. Is the counter set out?
Came out yesterday.
Okay.
Or
no.
Today.
No, haven't bought the Rituals counter set yet, but definitely planning on picking up the counter set.
I will, but again, like when we played, just flip the wound tokens over, which was a cool, like that's the little touches. We haven't talked about some of these little touches, like the texturing on the tokens is reminiscent of Beast Grave. Like they have that little bit to make them different from Underworlds, and then, you know, hey, we're not using the other side of this wound counter. Why don't we just flip it over? Now it's a token. So you got your ritual counter right there. But the ritual token is you start with one on the leader, and then you can burn it when you declare an attack before you roll dice to say, I'm going to get to reroll a dice in this. And then you'll get one for each enemy that goes out of action. I did double check this again, talking about lethals. The enemy just has to go out of action. So if you throw them in a fiery pit, that counts for a ritual counter.
Mm-hmm.
That gives them a little bit of stealth accuracy. You know, if you, it's not quite an extra dice, but it's almost an extra dice. So if you think of it as, you know, the first attack that the Beastigor is going to make is going to be kind of on three smash, or the Ungor making is on three fury, then it's looking a little bit better. And it's one of those snowball effects. So if you manage to kill with that first swing, then you get another one, you know, it'll stack up.
Yeah.
Speaking of killing, what do you think about the Inspire condition, Jeff?
It's a little scary. In certain matchups, I think it's going to be a little bit harder to trigger.
Sure. And two enemy fighters have to be out of action. Blanket
sorry,
Inspire
sorry,
across them. Sure.
Yeah. Which so the blanket Inspire is nice, right? Like, and I think that's the cost you're paying with this, right?
Mm.
That it's just suddenly if you get two, all of a sudden, you know, you're going off. And it's, I was saying the other day, I really want to see a Bestigor versus Reavers game. because there's just going to be one turn when everyone's just like, let's go. And
race to the bottom.
Yeah, exactly. But like, given that they're both these chaos infused armies, like you're like, oh, it makes so much sense. Like, I love this. So the inspire mechanic's a little concerning to me, especially because they're very much so chip damage outside of the Bestigor. And so I worry that they won't necessarily get on this till turn. You know, I think the earliest you're going to see this is turn two, most likely. Mm-hmm. Unless you're against, in most matchups, if you're against like Gabos or other stuff like that, you can probably pop this off. But it's definitely, it forces you to play a very specific aggressive way. Mm-hmm. And you're just looking to try to get that mechanic. Overall, I like it. It feels thematic. It feels interesting. And I don't feel it's that redundant. They feel different enough from other kill enemies to inspire warbands that it doesn't feel like a direct like cloning of another one.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that they gain so much from inspiring that, you know, it's one of those things where it has a potential to be a tough inspire or a real easy inspire. But maybe the biggest deal is the caster bumping up to two, right? As he starts at one. So depending on...
No, the caster stays at one.
I'm looking at Felhoof here. He bumps to a two magic level. It's that little symbol.
Oh, sorry. I was thinking you meant dodge.
No. Yeah.
Yes. Right. No, you're right. He does. Yeah. And is that not the first wizard we've ever seen that does that?
No, Thedra. No. Just everyone forgets
Thedra
that she's a wizard.
Thedra was the first.
Oh, yeah.
Because she's so bad at casting.
Fair statement. Yeah. But yeah, actually, overall, you're right. They gain small amounts. Mm-hmm. It's not like dwarves where it's like they're doomed if they don't inspire.
Right. And I think that was probably pretty intentional just to make it, if you go into a matchup where it's hard to inspire, that you're not just a lost cause. So not that it's nothing. You're still angling for it. But anybody got anything else they want to cover on these guys? And we should say that we'll take the opportunity down the line to give a deeper dive into these, where we talk more about, I guess off the top of your head, any universals scream out to you that you'd start thinking about salting in with these guys? Because they're stock, they come with a lot of fighter upgrades that might be specific to someone like Gnarl, a little Ungor with a bow who's very likely dead by the time you draw it. But
yeah, I feel like anything that's going to boost their accuracy is going to be helpful. I mean, having that reroll is nice, but you may only have the one until you can really get more kills rolling. And so a lot of them are rolling two dice to start with, and a lot of them are on two fury, which is, it's pretty bad. So I would personally think anything that's going to add more dice or give you more rerolls or something is what I would be looking at. But
yeah, I also think like Skirmisher, which is their faction specific ploy, which is plays after friendly fighters move action, not part of a charge action, this fighter may make a range 3 attack. I also think just throwing out more attacks is another way to compensate for their poor accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
And sure. I think we're going to need to see more attacks is going to be rarer in this season than it was in previous seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's going to be a critical way for them to just sort of pepper out more damage and try to get more board control.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, and I guess a fair point with that card, I mean, not to start deep diving too much here, but
yeah,
being able to have weapon upgrades can take advantage of that. So some room to play around with that. But.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I hope we get some... it'd be cool to get a hunter specific bow in like an elf pack later or something like that, or a stolen.
Sure.
It's like really good, and that the Ungors could like pick it up. Sure. And then they get, you know, dope ass bow, and then they do shoot some like gloriously overdone elvish bow with two damage or something like that.
Yeah. And that's a good point, because they have a number of ranged fighters, so some of that stuff like Glory Seeker or you know, that might be
Challenge Seeker too.
Yeah, might be worth investigating. But Phil, you were more excited about the Wild Hunt. You want to give us a quick rundown there?
Sure. So, obviously they're, you know, I think the thing that stood out to me first about these guys is that they're basically a new faction to, just Age of Sigmar lore. Like, we have not seen these guys before.
That's so dope.
And I kind of like that they are taking this opportunity to introduce new units into Age of Sigmar through Underworlds. Because it feels like such an easy way to just sort of have this light touch of just like, here's a sprinkle of something new that maybe we're going to be building on later. And it just builds hype. And they look sweet, in my opinion. I know some people are probably not jazzed about the hair, but I think they look sweet. And then the other thing is, like, they're just such a fast warband. They are all, except for the cat and the leader, speed 4 to start. And the cat and the leader are speed 5 to start. So it's like, let's just move even faster here.
Yeah.
And then everybody inspires up to speed 5. So you're as fast as Skaven, but you've got multiple ranged attacks. You've got a number of pretty accurate smash attacks for some decent damage. Like I think they're going to be a very finesse, very flexible warband, and it's something that I'm pretty excited about because I think you can play them in so many different ways. They're a little tougher than you'd expect, so I think they can sit on objectives all right. They're not just going to get blown up. Almost all of them are health 3.
That
which
surprised me when you're playing. I kept looking for which elf had 2 health and not finding it.
Yeah, just the cat, yeah. Who is definitely your, like, he's your chaff guy. He's the one who's not really doing a whole lot for you.
I believe the word you're looking for is dangle bro.
Yeah, ooh. He is the dangle bro.
One contribution to the world.
And they're surprisingly accurate.
Normally, they have a lot of hammers.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. So normally I sort of expect that ranged attacks are going to be fury more often than not. But all of their ranged attacks are actually on smash, which is very surprising to me. And so, like, they're going to be able to get you pretty, you know, accurately. And they inspire to get more accurate. Like, yeah. They don't hit very hard, which is maybe going to be their weakness. But if you can land almost all your attacks, as Davey noted in our game,
many times the salt was coming out.
It's very, very, it's very hard to feel like things are going to go right when every single time your little guys are getting hit. Because like what I noticed is you can sort of just use that accuracy to pick off weak fighters and work your way towards that snowball. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I just really love that flexibility.
Yeah.
I really love the charge attack on the leader.
Yeah.
Gets plus one damage on a 3 hammer range 3. It's just like, oh. So that's threat 8, 3 hammer 2 damage. And if he does it at the end of the round, he's inspired.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like, oh!
I think I saw you, Phil, playing with, because they have an upgrade for plus 2 speed. So you had what would have effectively been a
threat 10,
which is if the boards are placed wide, you can stand on your back line and threaten the other back line.
So. Yep.
which feels dope for a centaur, or like accurate for a centaur with a javelin. You're like, okay. Yeah. I feel fine with that. But the other two is actually there are two hunters, I guess. Yeah. Besides the leader, the two hunters, then when they inspire, they're still only one dodge, but they get a reroll that defense dice if they're the target of an attack action. That feels cool.
Yeah.
That just feels great. It gives them a little bit more survivability. And I liked that the way that they gave them more accuracy wasn't through additional dice, but through the melee character gets cleave and the ranged character gets ensnare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it just, that does really feel super, super good.
I mean, the melee character got more dice too, but.
Sure.
He does. You're right.
Well, but it's a clever, talking about the reroll dodge, or the reroll on defense, it's a clever way to find a middle ground between bumping them all the way to 2 dodge and leaving them at 1. They're better defense there, but there's still a way, like if I roll a crit and a success, then okay, it doesn't matter that you have a reroll, I'm going to get through on this, you know, so. I thought that was a neat way to find the sort of the middle ground that is probably about right for him.
Yep.
Awesome. Some of the stealth benefit of that is that if your opponent has ensnare, it gives you a better chance of rolling crits too.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And range 3, 2 hammer and snare is, that is scary.
Yeah, well, and it synergizes nicely with the horn action where blows the horn.
Talk about that.
Rerolls are, you know, rerolls like those smash dice, the hammer dice, a little better because they're more likely to produce something. So that's probably a little nod there, a little synergy.
Yep.
So something I forgot to mention while I was running these guys down is that. So like the ritual token, they have their own token, but it is an action to gain it. You don't just start with one. And you don't get to choose when you use the token. So once you have it, as soon as you make another attack, you have to use it, which I think is probably the biggest downside to the reroll for the elves, just because you do lose some of that flexibility. But you do get to reroll all the dice in the attack roll. So when you already have like 3 hammers, if you can reroll any of them, your chances of succeeding on that attack are pretty much guaranteed, which I think is really strong. But the action economy for it feels like it might make it a pretty rare play.
Mm-hmm. I can see later rounds when you've got that big threat range, you know, you're not in danger of being attacked by the other guy, but you're gonna have to charge to get them, so you can power up to send a really powerful hit in or something like that. So
sure.
Any other thoughts on Skaith's Wild Hunt before we move it along here?
I think that's good for now.
Okay. So we've taken a look at what's in the box. It just so happens there's been some other things sort of coinciding with that. We're gonna cover those a few of those real quick here. We've talked about, let's see, just today we learned that part of a competitive play, they are rotating out a board. They're rotating out the Shattered City board pack. So give me your thoughts. We already knew, obviously, last episode we talked about card rotation. Give me your thoughts about rotating out boards in general and specifically that board pack. What are you thinking there, Jeff?
As a sucker who bought that board pack, I'm fine with them rotating it out. I don't think they were very good boards. I think given the new inclusion of lethal hexes, those boards are unlikely to see a lot of play except by ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, it might be like there's a power imbalance there. And I think like, yeah, it's painful. People spent $24 on a board. But it's these are the costs we need to pay to get a really tight competitive game that's super fun and exciting. And so I'm actually totally fine with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it also opens up an opportunity in the future where it's unlikely you would do this, I could see, but it would be cool to have events where you have Shadespire, like if they resold all the old boards that are supposedly out of print, you know, can't find a box of Shadespire, you're not supposed to be able to find a box of Nightfall soon. It would be cool if they did an event that was just Shadespire boards or just Nightfall boards or just Beastgrave boards.
Sure. Yeah, don't throw them away. Hang on to them. Who knows?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other part of the rotation is that with the relic system that they announced as part of this, you know, you can use those boards in that, right? Like if one store is going to do a relic tournament as a fun thing once a year, then you can bring all that super janky, broken, wild stuff out.
Sure. yeah, I guess I jumped kind of ahead of the story, which is the three ways. There's Relic, Alliance, and Competitive. And Competitive is the one that we're used to thinking about. That's got the card rotation. Relic is play with just about anything. I think they have some, they call it Forsaken is the new word for banned. Forsaken cards. Forsaken and restricted cards. I don't think anything's restricted in Relic. And then Alliance is the team event where nobody duplicates a card on their side. But yeah, anyway. Back to it. You're saying there. You know, who knows what other events might. You know, there's just room to do things a little bit different.
Yeah, and like competitive is going to need those sorts of things. Like that's how you make a game that's going to consistently grow and feel and not have power imbalances from the past. And you just have to accept it. Like it's a living, breathing part of this. Every competitive game, every genuinely competitive game, has bans. And I know 40K doesn't, but that's because 40K isn't a genuinely competitive game. and no, but like if like Magic, yeah. Which is the unequivocal king of a game store. It may every game store you go to is open, probably because Magic pays most of the bills. Every version of Magic has bans and rotations, and it's just part of it. And I don't even like Magic, but I respect that part of it.
Sure.
You know, X-Wing has rotations for ships as part of hyperspace. A lot of people really prefer hyperspace for that reason. It's more avenues for new players to come in. When I look at Beastgrave, I see it as a place where a player isn't trying to track down who gets into it, isn't trying to track down something that's out of print from 2 years ago. And so with this board, it's like, yeah, you don't have to go buy a $24 overpriced board you're not going to pay for.
But and you might not even be able to find. I mean, I think there's a practical consideration there. Is it's,
yeah, absolutely.
Difficult to find. I think that's a good way to kind of ease people into the idea of it. Like, this will come out. And the other practical consideration is, you know, a couple years' time, I don't want to go to an event and carry, you know, 35 pounds of boards, you know, to
to stay. Have a whole separate bag just for your
board. Yeah. You've got like a satchel of just boards with you.
Like those disc golfers get that big bag with
a
slot in it.
Yeah.
So boards, it wasn't as obvious that, you know, there wasn't, I was going to say there's not a ready for action board, although, and it hasn't been rotated out, the magma vault, the lava pit one, you know, there's some of those boards have felt oppressive at different times, but I don't think there's one that anyone looks at and says, well, that's, you know, that's the ready for action of boards, you know, so.
I feel like board choice is so warband and matchup specific that it, like, there's never going to be that default choice, right? There's never going to be a situation where it's, well, I have to play this board because it's super strong compared to the others. Like, they're going to be maybe super strong for my warband, but like, maybe depending on the matchup you see across from you, you may have to suddenly change that tactic because it may actually be a hindrance against that opponent.
Yeah, I think that's generally true outside of the ghosts. Who I feel are just like, how many lethal hexes can I get on the board?
Yeah, actually, and yet another consideration is both those boards, both sides of those boards are pretty crowded. The one's got three lethals scattered. The other one's got blocked in lethals. I imagine with placing additional lethals, it gets pretty messy on those boards pretty quick. So that might be a reason they were targeted.
Yeah, I mean, I have a friend who bought the Night Vault box. He's bought all the expansions, but the only army he's ever painted and played competitively is Night Vault. Not Night Vault, it's the Banshees. And he loves that faction. Mm-hmm. It's great. And this morning he messaged me and he's like, he's like, oh, they banned the board. And I was like, how are you feeling about that? He's like, yeah, it seems fair. Honestly, it's just like, it was like starting to read because he picked up his copy last night and he's like, it was starting to read like I could get four lethal hexes easily on the board. And I think I didn't check the card, but isn't there a card where you can flip an objective over, a spell you can flip an objective over with now?
We saw a preview of it. I don't know if it's in the
course. It's not out yet.
Yeah, okay. But it's all of a sudden, it's just like, oh my God. Like, if they can have five lethals on their side of the board, it's, you know, just be like, no!
And the crazy thing, so that spell, if I'm remembering correctly, it's on two focus, but it's all of the hexes on that caster's side of the board when they cast it.
Mm. Oh,
so it could be way more lethal hexes than five. Yeah. No, it could be as many as like 10.
Place the hex. Well, yes, it could be 10. You would never. Well, what's interesting is you would never place when you place your objectives, you absolutely aren't going to place anything on their side of the board at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just think they're problematic design spaces, that was all. And those were the first boards with lethals, I think, right?
They were. And everyone was like, why would I ever take a board with lethals? Because at the time...
And then they're like, calculated risks.
Yeah, calculated risks, and then also the ghosts are just gimme.
Yeah.
Other things that we've seen, and this is... I don't know if this has even been officially announced yet. It was... People figured it out by looking at the official deck builder option. A change to moving us to the maximum number of surge that is score immediately objectives you could take in a deck is 6.
That was officially announced today.
Okay. All right.
In the formats.
Okay.
So you can only take a maximum of 6 score immediately?
Yes. In competitive.
Oh. dear, my Thunderers are upset.
And I think that's every Thunder player's reaction. So,
yeah. I'll be honest. I think it's better design space. So
I agree. I think it makes the end phase valuable again.
Like, yeah, it makes it relevant
like,
again.
Yeah, instead no, of like, you're absolutely right, Phil. Yeah. Like, it's, I'm just thinking through my deck, and I'm like, yeah, no, I have to actually play the game. Okay.
Well, it's instead of the end phase being like, here's where I compound my score abilities by scoring, you know, combination strike and opening gambit and solid gains. It's now, all right, here's where I'd score the things that I had to work the whole turn through to get to a position where they're scorable. So I'm a fan of that change myself. I think we're still, you know, I've been building decks with that restriction for a little while just to try it out. It is a different beast entirely. Combined with the rotation, oof, boy. So,
the rotation plus that is definitely going to make Thunderers are going to be in an exciting new spot.
Yeah. Although, hopefully, I mean, I get the impression they may still be doing okay. It'll definitely.
I'm not super worried. Yeah. I'll be honest. Their base stat lines are just so good that like I think you can make it work.
Yeah. So we've kind of covered a number of our questions here. We'll just see if we got any cleanup to do, and I'm gonna end up doing exactly what I said I would try not to do, which is say, hey, this person had a question, we answered it. But Aman was asking us how we felt about the Shattered City board being rotated out. We kind of touched on that. Max is wondering, Max Bernstein of the Battle for Salvation Warhammer Underworlds podcast, he wants to know, do you think that they're doing something to mitigate power creep that seemed to be brewing in Night Vault? Specifically, he's talking about, he's using a term pillow fisted that he stole from Shuby. I heard that a lot in Privateer Press games. Pillow fisted is a term for saying that these two warbands don't put out a lot of damage. Is that, you think it's an intentional attempt to make sure that it doesn't power creep, or?
Well, I think in actual fact, it's also responding to participate in conjunction with the rotation of the season one stuff, that overall lethality is going to go down.
Mm-hmm.
And so I need to play more to know, but I don't feel like they're inherently pillow fisted. By the game you guys were even talking about earlier, it didn't sound like the elves missed much at all. No,
they did not.
And so, but it's, for me, it's like the game's more exciting if there's a lot of hits, but stuff dies slower.
Mm-hmm.
Because it means there's more moments of choice. You have stronger reaction opportunities. You can sacrifice units and so forth. And I really like want to caution everyone, you know, all the free kit about the rotation has just, you know, been never ending. But I really want us to caution about defining what the meta looks like until we get past that first Grand Clash in the SoCal Open on that opening weekend in October. Because that's when we're really going to start to see a lot of the creative thinking come out around how to build this post-rotation. And I think overall, one of the things we are going to see is a reduction in lethality, and that's okay.
Yeah, I'd agree. Yeah. That kind of feeds in. There's Boone or Sloth on Twitter was asking, it specifically says, well, so his impression, he says, feels like the season is going to be much more killy with an emphasis on lethal hexes and damage from lots of different sources. So he's seeing it from a different perspective. We're looking at it from the specifically these warbands, but with the lethal hexes and with some of the other sources, he specifically is asking, well, where do we think that leaves the beefier warbands? And his examples are Cursebreakers and Iron Jaws. So I think we're talking about, you know, the warbands that are bringing multiple fighters with four health. You know, where do we speculate they stand as far as this goes?
So having been working on the hunt here, and I mean, you're definitely right in that their base damage is pretty low. And that is potentially a concern. Like between stacking things like Pit Trap and a Snare and using things like Encroaching Shadows and stuff like that, there's a lot of ways that I was finding that I can boost my damage without actually boosting my damage characteristic. And I think that's almost worse than knowing that your opponent has a 4 damage attack that can come in and just kill you. Because it's going to be a situation where they're like, I shoot you for 1, I knock you into a lethal, I play Pit Trap, and then I'll play, you know, Encroaching Shadow or something because you're now on a adjacent to a edge hex. And it's like, and I just did 4 damage, but it probably came out of nowhere and you didn't know it was coming. Mm-hmm. And so I do kind of wonder if there's going to be some of these stealth kills where you're holding onto a hand of stuff that can add one or two damage, and all of a sudden your opponent is like, oh crap, I wasn't prepared for that because I was looking across the board and thought, you've only got one or two damage fighters.
I do think, though, that the counter to that is twofold. One, by it needing multiple cards, and this is a lesser of two counters, by it needing multiple cards, you open up the opportunity for more reaction windows from your opponent.
It's true.
Where they can break up the combo if they start to see it coming, which rewards a bit more of the gambit of you having to bluff that you have that combo. They play the reaction and maybe you didn't have it and so forth and so on. But the other part is, to pull that combo off, you just went through what you described was you just went through 3/5 of a power hand on an opening gambit versus one character with 4 damage. Mm-hmm. And so you are, the price to accomplish that is much higher than having that innate damage on a character.
Yeah, no, for sure. But I guess to the point of the sort of the question of like, where does this leave some of these beefy warbands? I think in those cases where adding one or two damage makes the difference, if it's killing a third of a warband or 25% of a warband.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry.
All of a sudden now it's like, oh crap, I got killed and wasn't expecting it, and now I'm on the back foot because I don't have enough fighters left to deal with it and have a counterpunch.
Yeah. I mean, one example, though, somebody who might be pretty decently off, you know, who was a douche and is still a douche is Gartok, who is not getting, not getting driven back into any of these lethals or getting snared or anything like that. So.
I agree. I think Magors are going to have a strong place, at least in this early meta. I think they're going to be very good. So I honestly, I mean, I guess to sort of give an opinion just overall in the sort of killiness of the meta, I think it's not very changed. It's going to look a little different, but I think overall the game's going to play a lot like it has, and like Molag's still going to smash you. There's still going to be plenty of damage around. You're never going to feel like you can't get kills. I think you're just going to have to think about it a little bit more than you maybe had to before.
Yeah. You know, we ended up getting a number of questions that are asking about where do we think the meta is. And the problem is that things are so new. So Kevin on Twitter wants to know, are there any seasoned warbands that got better after rotation? Like we're saying exactly here, Magors, I think, might be looking pretty good.
Yeah.
But again, it's speculation. He wants to know, can anything stand up, anything from season one stand up to all Magic Curse Breakers? Maybe, it's hard to, Steve Findle wants to know is, where do we leave objective play? This feels like one of those environments where so many variables have changed. You know, instead of it being, hey, here's this one thing that changed, it's this board, you know, some boards are going away and a whole bunch of cards went away and score immediately have shifted. And so it's really unstable ground to make a lot of predictions on because, you know, every time you think of, oh, this warband lost this, well, they gained this. You know, you think with Thorns, like, well, they lost some of their tactical supremacies. That stinks. But, well, actually, there's a lot of lethals, and they don't care about those. So that helps them. And they have great in-faction cards, so that helps them, you know. I don't know. I understand where these questions are coming from. They're real hard to address, though. Yeah.
Well, I actually think the address them, we've sort of come about this in X-Wing. So we have points adjustments about every 6 months in that game now. Mm-hmm. And it totally shakes up the game and it's really great. And I would say that one of the things that Underworlds really could benefit from this is like the what's going to be really good is like we're in the Wild West, right? Like with the rotation out and then these new factions and all these new cards and all this. It's one of these things of like you're not going to win you're not going to go win a tournament this weekend, next weekend, you know, the week after, by just finding some net deck right now, because things are going to be evolving so fast that net deck this early in a meta won't have solutions to other creative problems. What you should really ask yourself is, hey, what would I love to see the meta be? Or what would I love to play into the meta that I think would be strong? Not having a strong sense of where the meta is actually going to be. Mm-hmm. And then go build that deck and iterate on it. Mm-hmm. Because this is the time where you'll actually be able to find success with almost anything, because players don't really know where a lot of the sort of mismatch power is. And so it's actually time for you as a player not to look for the net deck, but to look for where can you express yourself. And that for me is exciting. And I know for some players that's either intimidating or it's not very engaging or that's not what they want to see. And in that case, it's like, then you should wait, right? Like, there isn't going to be a net deck answer right now. But I'm really liking the idea of just going out to find, like, for example, with Fire Slayers, I really want to go try to build objective Fire Slayers.
Yeah.
Like, with the drive back on guard, I'm like, I want to see if that's there. I don't know if it's good, but I want to see if it's there. Sure. And I can think of a lot of reasons not to go do that. But if there's any point I'm going to find success doing it, it's right now.
Yeah. And I know this is something that you've mentioned a lot before, Davey, but like the more that the game is in flux, I think the better it is for the game, because it gets people thinking, it brings out new ideas, it changes up these, you know, preconceived notions of what's good. And so, you know, I think tiers have never really applied to this game particularly well anyway, but if they ever did, like, you've got to blow all those lists up right now, because you can't really know where anything's going to land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's important to even think about all the predictions we're making or other people are making, and then think about back to the start of Night Vault. Magic was in there. We had a couple Universal Gambit spells. And generally people are like, I don't know what's going on with Magic. Like, this seems like maybe a little bit of a waste of time. And by the end, you know, everyone's talking about how great Magic is and oh, those Curse Breakers and such. So all that is still out there to play for, as far as, you know, Hunter and Quarry, see where that develops into, see how people start to leverage these lethals, all, you know, see what, you know, end phase objectives start, and we have a whole season of Universals to drop into. So, yeah, it's good stuff. It's a good spot to be at. That about gets us to our questions. I could give you one quick hit if you want to try and consider this one. Jason Murray was wondering if you pick, so of all the different changes, all the different rules that we've talked about, what do we think will be the biggest impact on the game? Is there one that feels like, well, this is the biggest change, be it from the box or from the competitive play?
The roll off at the start of the game on boards.
Yeah, all right, I like that.
I feel it's universal agency expression for every warband.
Sure,
definitely.
And it absolutely impacts every game, right? Because there's a roll off every game. Good choice, Phil.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn between that and the number of surge cards you can have in your deck. I think putting another restriction on the deck building is obviously going to have a pretty huge impact on how the game just ends up being played. And so I think that could be a real big shakeup. But I think just generically from every single game perspective, the roll-off is going to just be such a nice quality of life improvement that people will probably just be happy with having that agency.
Mm-hmm. I'd say for me, it's the combo of a whole new season of cards coming in coupled with rotation of season one, because it gives all these new cards we're seeing room to grow and impact and all that, instead of being crowded out by that season one, what was in there. It makes you all the more excited to see what's coming out, because you know that it's not like it has to be able to displace these other old standbys, you know, change of tactics or whatever the case may be. And it's been fun. It's been a ton of fun for me to play and not see those, you know, not, oh, I'll just play upgrades because I'm not worried about escalation, you know, like,
oh my God.
Yeah.
And then I played because we're still letting folks use some of the season one just to help ease the transition. I think over the course of this league that our current league season, we're going to slowly rotate them out. But I'd played enough without them that it was shocking when I was playing on Thursday and went in, throw down a big attack, and he's like, okay, I'm going to try rebound. I was like, oh my gosh, like heart attack all over again. No. I forgot this is even a thing.
No.
So it was fine. It was fine to see that and play against it again. But just remembering like, oh yeah, man, it is different and cool to not be worrying about some of this stuff anymore. And that makes it sound like a negative. It's this positive of like what else is out there? What am I going to get surprised by that somebody's going to do? And so more than I can remember in recent memory, I've been, you know, people play a card. I'm like, okay, that sounds great. Now, tell me what that card is. Cause I have no idea, you know?
Yeah, yep. Exactly. Yeah,
so
yep.
That's a fun way to be playing. So
yeah, no, absolutely.
I think that's about going to do it for us. Jeff, you got any last thoughts you want to throw out here?
I'm worried that this season may not have a Dwarven Warband.
I'm pretty sure it does not.
Well, okay. I mean, this is upsetting. My hope is that with the inclusion of the Hunt as a Warband and the release of the Free Cities, mm-hmm. that they will release a Dispossessed Warband later in the season.
Oh, okay.
As like a traditional Dwarven Warband with like a Thunderer, a Ranger, a Warrior, a Longbeard, something like that.
That'd be fun.
It would be fun. I don't think they're going to do it. And I'm really worried because, you know, without Dwarven characters, I don't understand why anyone actually plays this game. And that's concerning. I just need to express that.
We'll do a quick aside. Just give us a few seconds. We saw officially announced a little while ago Rippa Snarlfangs, the Wolf Riders, and then today was the official announcement for Grimwatch, the Flesh Eater Courts warbands. And we mentioned both those earlier. Death is continuing its motif of seven fighter warbands. They got a bat swarm for whatever reason, and then
those models look really cool.
They do. Flesh Eater Courts for me are always like thematically super cool, and I struggle a little bit with the models, but those they did some great stuff with those. There's some, you know, a guy with double meat hooks, like what? Cool. A guy with a sweet ghoul beard. I don't know. There's all kinds of cool stuff there. And the Snarlfangs, that looks pretty exciting too. So what they're going to do with them. Phil, any last thoughts here?
No, I don't. I think we did a pretty good rundown.
All right. So we're going to start wrapping it up here. We will do our usual. You can talk to us on Twitter at WTHcast, whatthehexcast@gmail.com. Jeff, you still have the Claim the City page, and is that where we'd see announcements when this sort of documentary podcast season one?
So Brandon and I from Claim the City have been working on actually like a long form documentary style podcast around the tabletop industry as a whole. Mm-hmm. Yes, it will be announced on there. We're just finishing up writing the first season, and then we're going to record it. It's really different than anything else we've ever done. I have no idea if anyone will want to listen to it. But it's basically just Brandon and I get into these really heated arguments at the game store sometimes around a lot of like the really just irrational marketing plans or merchandising decisions or product decisions or design choices. And based on our experience working in video games for so long now, we are like, this just feels like 10, 15 year old video game decisions. Mm-hmm. And we just sort of want to express like, hey, as a customer and consumer in this space, here's all these things that we think people should be asking more from these companies to do, because we think it would be better. And being very like solution oriented. It's not a news podcast or anything like that. It's much more of like, the first season is 6 episodes, and we're just going to release it. It covers marketing, design, production, merchandising, community, and competitive. And we just want to put it out there, and then we're going to build seasons on after that, looking at specific games through those lenses. Not really as reviews or as news, but much more of a sort of imagine it having a physical done, like a whole medical exam of an entire game.
Sure.
Okay. Where you look at everything aspect of it. But games that exist in the market right now, like War Machine or 40K or games that are new, like Crisis Protocol or Beastgrave. And so just trying to go through all those with that kind of a lens. And then bringing in a bunch of experts that we know from inside the industry and out to talk about a lot of this stuff as well.
Very cool. So if people are looking to stay up to date on that, then their best bet is to watch your Claim the City Facebook page?
Or yeah, for now, watch Claim the City, and then when it comes out, we've purchased the domains and social medias for it and everything, so all that's secured. They'll just see it slammed in their face repeatedly, constantly, for like a week or two.
All right. Let us know. We'll pop it up, too, on our channels for the masses of people who are paying attention to us. So normally I would do a thanks here for people who've done reviews. I've been remiss, though. I want to take a quick opportunity to say a big thanks to one of our local guys, Vint, who is running the store, the Warhammer store here. He's through his efforts, he's got, when we go in for Thursday night, which is our Underworlds League night, and Warcry is cohabitating at that point. It was shoulder to shoulder, elbow to elbow, every inch of table space being used for games, and it was really cool to see such a concentration. And we've been working with him, and Eric from the Mortal Realms and Dogs of Warcry has been working with him to try and create these leagues, and it's paying dividends, and I really appreciate his sort of effort and vision on that, and hope that everyone out there can have a local guy who puts that same kind of effort in to setting up his community. So
yeah, I will say that if you don't have that in your store, in my experience, if you put the investment in, you'll get it, yeah. And it is so worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. But in the meantime, you can catch us next. Remember, we're going to be a little time disjointed as we kind of filter in some of these recordings that we've got, and who knows if the right stuff is coming out. We may have to jump the gun and jump in with something else, but that'll be filtering in. Your recommended listening for this episode, we're going to go with Shallow Grave by Tallest Man on Earth and Leave the City, Farewell to You, Shadespire by Magnolia Electric Company. For What the Hex, I've been Davey.
This is Phil.
I'm Jeff. I'm not going to get on that horse. I don't need to become a martyr for that problem in this community.
I think the last time we had you on, you were calling a defensive play a cancer. So
I will stand on that horse.
We're leaning on you for those strong opinions to polarize.
I actually.